The Word of Mouth podcast is brought to you by
Dartmouth Hitchcock. Imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community.
With convenient locations throughout northern New England,
world-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more.
Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
Word of Mouth.
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 Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott.
You have your own sense of style. The way you dress, the music you listen to, the way you think are all distinctly you. Why wouldn't the way you move be the same?
That's an ad for a new mobility device called the Wheel Model M, a compact-powered wheelchair. Its manufacturers boast that the Model M's tight turning radius and ability to handle any terrain allows the freedom to go anywhere you want. Mobility devices are undergoing a surge of innovation, allowing unprecedented levels of accessibility, if you can afford them. David Perry is a disability rights journalist and a history professor at Dominican University. He attended an Abilities Expo in Chicago, where top-of-the-line mobility devices and assistive technology were on display. He wrote about the widening gap between innovation and affordability for Pacific Standard Magazine. And David Perry, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thanks so much for having me.
Now, you saw a variety of these devices, like the wheelchair we just heard about. How much does that one cost?
That one costs about $14,000, and it is not covered by any insurance plan. You know, they talk about themselves as like the Tesla. They want to be disrupting the personal mobility device market. I don't know about you, but I also can't afford a Tesla. So that's, you know, their model is not about affordability, but about innovation and disruption.
Well, I learned from your reporting that devices are coded by the FDA, and that steers whether or not insurance companies will cover them. So what does that mean? How do they distinguish these project codes in their database?
So there's a large process when you create something that is intended to serve a medical purpose in terms of getting it approved by the FDA for that medical purpose and then getting it into their system to be covered by insurance. And then there's still, even if things are coded, lots of bureaucratic hoops to maybe go through in order for any individual to acquire that device. So you have to meet various kinds of standards, and this is, on some level, certainly very good. We wouldn't want people selling a product as life-sustaining or independence-granting technology that wasn't held to very high standards. But it also means that you have to conform to certain kinds of guidelines. It does, I think, limit innovation. And then also it creates a situation where the product is not about consumer pricing and affordability, but about making it work within a system in which the end user often doesn't see the price, has no real relationship to the price. If they did, they couldn't afford it, just like most of us just can't go out and buy an MRI. You know, there's a dollar number associated with all kinds of medical procedures and pharmaceuticals and wheelchairs and so on and so forth, but our whole system is geared to sort of hide that from the consumer, hide that from the individual, unless, of course, you don't have health insurance, or your health insurance chooses not to cover something that's very important to you, and then there's no real redress.
Well, how about something like this Tesla-esque model of the Wheel M? How advanced are these new devices, and does it offer users things they are not getting from the traditional, let's say, the Honda Civic version? You know, are they really offering more access, or is it just about luxury?
Well, I think to some extent you'd have to talk to a lot of different wheelchair users. And I want to make clear that I'm not a wheelchair user. I'm the father of a boy with Down syndrome. I write about disability issues of all sorts for many different publications. They certainly look nice. I do think their ability to turn tightly and to go over some obstacles is superior to other kinds of powered wheelchairs. They don't have the big supports that other kinds of powered wheelchairs have, so it really depends on what your needs are. I'm sure there is an individual out there who would find the turning radius and the speed and sort of the smoothness of the control, the ability to drive one on Bluetooth on your cell phone, to have some real accessibility gains. I also don't think that style and luxury is inconsequential in a world in which we often really stigmatize people with disabilities, especially people with visible disabilities who get looked at and stared at and feel cut off from society. And having something sleek and stylish is not an inconsequential advance.
Matt, you talk to a number of people who have different perceptions about these devices. How do users describe these kind of tools that they depend on?
So one of the interesting things about wheelchairs and other personal mobility devices, I should say that manufacturers of these devices are very careful as what's a wheelchair, because that's approved by the FDA, and what's a mobility device, that's not a medical device. But for our purposes, we can just say wheelchairs. I think generally in society, wheelchairs get a pretty bad rap. Journalists still use the phrase wheelchair-bound or confined to wheelchairs. Wheelchairs are seen by people who don't use one every day as something you are stuck in when you get sick or when you get hurt, or when you're in the hospital. People who use wheelchairs for their everyday mobility have entirely different perspective. I've spoken to dozens of wheelchair users, and the number one word is freedom, and the second word is independence. That's what a functioning wheelchair means to someone who needs one, freedom and independence. Well, that makes the stakes pretty high, because if their wheelchair isn't functioning, or if they can't afford it, or if they can't get one that properly meets their needs, they're not free, they're not independent.
We're speaking with David Perry, a disability rights journalist who wrote about the high cost of some high-tech mobility devices for Pacific Standard. So how are patients who do want one of these models or any device that isn't covered by insurance, how are they paying for them?
Well, unfortunately, I have to say I see a lot of people crowdfunding their medical needs. And this is not just for mobility devices, but all kinds of medical needs. And the disability community is a relatively poor one, but is also a relatively generous one, and we do try to come together and support each other, and we celebrate when someone successfully meets their needs. I talk in my article about a filmmaker named Dominic Evans, a wonderful person, very well known in our community, whose lift broke, and to get a lift to physically get him out of bed, it broke and wasn't getting replaced. And then when he did crowdfund the lift, his wheelchair wasn't working because he hadn't sat in it for a long time because he had been confined to bed. And he's trying to crowdfund his way to these better devices, and I have contributed. I'm all for it. But I also see crowdfunding as fundamentally an indictment of our failure to support people and to meet their needs. That anyone who's trying to crowdfund an essential medical expense has been betrayed by our system.
And he's got a profile. You know, a lot of people know
That's
about
right.
him. I'm not sure if everybody could get their friends all to fund a medical device or even a medical procedure.
That's right. I mean, we see people trying to crowdfund cancer treatments and crowdfund care for their children. I mean, I'm all for crowdfunding when it comes to indie rock bands. I have one. I'm very happy to have crowdfunded an album. I think that's great. When it comes to fundamental rights, I think it's a problem.
Well, wheelchairs are not the only devices subject to bureaucracy, high cost. You mentioned that you have a son with Down syndrome, and your family had an experience with the device that your son needed. What was it, and how much did that cost?
Yeah, it was sort of incredible. So when you're under three, your child can enter early intervention, and a lot of medical costs are really very well covered. It's a wonderful program, and one that ultimately saves a lot of money, because if you meet needs early, often later on in life, the needs are lessened, and so the state needs to support less. It became very clear, though, that he was not developing understandable verbal speech at a rapid rate, and that one of the solutions was to get a device that would have icons and words that you can press, and it says the word out loud so that anyone can understand it. And this is something that can grow with him over time, and there's a lot of technology around this. It's wonderful technology. Well, the insurance programs would pay for a formally approved, durable medical device that only did talking, only did this kind of talking, involved a lot of craft work, a lot of cutting and pasting, literally cutting and pasting and laminating and recording everything. It was not very flexible, and it cost about $3,000. The better technology was a $600 iPad and a $200 app, and eventually that's what we went with the help of a donor. But again, that's not a system. So We have this iPad. He still uses it. We have the app. It's called Proloquo to Go. It's one of a number of high-end speech apps out there. They grow over time. The vocabulary expands. They're very flexible. And the really important thing to me is that when my son is 16 or 17, I fully expect him to have an app like that on his phone, which he'll carry everywhere, and to be able to use it to speak really easily and just pull out a phone. So we have a less effective tool that costs thousands of dollars more but is covered by insurance versus a more effective tool that is cheaper and will grow over time but is totally not covered.
I guess, David, the challenge here is figuring out what's absolutely necessary to function and to have access. If you do have this sort of beautiful, high-tech, highly designed wheelchair and other models in the tens of thousands of dollars, will insurance companies be facing the question of, you have to pay for this for me, this is just meeting my basic needs? I mean, where's the line there?
I would like people to think about the basic things they take for granted in terms of being able to access public space, move through their private space, communicate with people either face-to-face or through virtual means, by which I mean the internet, but also things like phone calls or watching television and understanding what's going on, being able to work to the extent of one's abilities and skills. These kinds of things many people can just take for granted, but there are so many people with disabilities who, in fact, could move freely in public space and could work and could watch television and could communicate if only we invested and supported basic pieces of assistive technology. And it's important to realize that although the wheelchair costs $14,000, which sounds like a lot, many devices that are covered right now cost much more, including heavily built up and tilting and moving powered wheelchairs. I saw an exoskeleton that helps people walk called ReWalk that costs $77,000, but it's covered by insurance. So right now there are millions and millions, maybe billions of dollars being spent on these products. And the question is, are we spending them in ways that accentuate possibility, that free people to be as independent as possible? Or are we spending that money in ways that the system's moving, but that doesn't really change the lived realities for people with disabilities?
So where, David, do we go from here?
Well, I think we keep pushing on insurance companies and on the FDA, but also on companies to try to build more flexibility into the system and to build more accountability. And it really depends on where you're looking, that there's the big Medicare and Medicaid systems that still have enormous, complex bureaucratic hoops that are very frustrating for people, often people who may have communication or mobility needs. So if you add a whole lot of forms and phone calls and waiting on hold, that may add another level of difficulty. We need to streamline, but really for me it's about individualizing and about thinking hard when we invest heavily in technology. Who's going to be able to access this technology? And if your answer is, well, only the super rich, I'm not sure that's so worth your time.
Well, David Perry, thank you for speaking with us.
It was my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
David Perry, he's a disability rights journalist and history professor at Dominican University, and wrote about that tension between innovative technology and cost for Pacific Standard. The article, You Shouldn't Have to Crowdfund Your Wheelchair, can be found at our website, wordofmouthradio.org. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. The tiny house and micro-apartment movements are sweeping American cities and towns. In cities, these teeny units are proposed as a stylish, affordable solution for the homeless and as a way to keep young urbanites from getting squeezed out of the rental market. Alexis Sobel-Fitz looked into the psychological ramifications of living in cramped spaces and found that micro-living may result in another kind of squeeze. Alexis is co-anchor of the Cross Sections blog and contributing writer for Undark. That's where we found her article on the psychology of living in small spaces. And Alexis, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you, Virginia.
So the tiny house movement, that's been gaining momentum for some time. Just remind us, what's the argument for wanting to live in a tiny house?
The tiny house movement is something that's really happening because we have a large number of urbanites who are marrying later and they're remaining single for longer, and they're increasingly locating themselves in cities. And they may not be ready for a large family home, but increasingly someone in their 30s who's unmarried won't want to live with roommates. So tiny homes are really a phenomenon of a new social situation that we're finding ourselves in.
So this has been going on for a while, as we said, rural suburban places. But how about Carmel Place? Now, this is a complex that started welcoming residents this spring in New York City. How much space in those units?
So Carmel Place has studio rentals that are between 252 and 360 square feet, which for New York is not not all that small, but compared to units around the country where typically there's an imposed limitation of 400 square feet minimum for apartment rentals.
And how much do they cost?
They start at about $2,500 per month and range up into the 3,000s.
You spoke to some scholars and looked at some studies on how small spaces can affect psychology. What are some of the findings?
So there isn't much research on the effects of living in a small space for a single person. But housing crowding, which is defined as having more people in a unit than there are rooms, has been linked to all sorts of things, including social withdrawal, stress, and aggravation. And there's a number of researchers that believe that crowded housing, most importantly, may have a trickle-down effect on the kids who are raised in these kinds of units. There's studies showing that children who spend their high school years in crowded households, which is defined in that study as a home with more family members than there are rooms, those children are less likely to graduate high school and complete college by age 25. But as I found in the article, it's hard to control for what in these studies happens because of the tiny space and what happens because of poverty.
Right. There's often an association of people crowded into an apartment because they can't afford something else.
Exactly.
So the micro apartment unit has been proposed as a housing option for lower income residents. How is that changing things for them?
Well, it really remains to be determined how much tiny homes will actually provide a different outcome for people in homeless populations. A well-designed micro unit or tiny home might be a fantastic option for housing people who are housing insecure. One thing that research shows is that one of the most important things for children in their home space is stability and privacy. So being in a tiny unit where the children and parents don't have to move often and are able to remain secure in their home and set up a comfortable home base might be a better option for children than ushering between larger apartments that may be less stable.
Yeah, it sounds like I can imagine this for millennials, right? You know, those in the creative economy just starting out in the city. Not so much for a low-income family. But what if these single millennials, they get married, they start a family? Is there room for expansion in these kind of units?
So the worry with micro units is that they drive up housing prices in urban environments so that residents become used to paying more money for less space. And then those residents who pay more money for less space, when they want to upgrade, maybe they're having a family, maybe they've been married, and they want to upgrade to more space, they're priced out of those larger spaces. That said, small spaces, if they're well designed, can absolutely accommodate a family. What's needed for adequate family housing is space for privacy for each member of the family and elegant design, views, all things that can be accomplished in a small amount of space if it's well designed.
Would you live in a micro apartment, Alexis?
Oh, I absolutely would. Especially the ones at Carmel Place are beautiful and very nicely designed. Unfortunately, they're a little bit out of my price range.
Well, I was thinking that for $2,570, there aren't a lot of homeless people or economically insecure people who would be able to do that.
Right. Well, there's a real difference between these studies on people who are housing insecure, who are raising families in crowded apartments, and single millennials who are living in small luxury units that might have communal outdoor space. They might have communal lounges. They might have all sorts of resources to give residents more space than the one tiny unit. So really, it's a matter of figuring out what the science is applying to before making any conclusions about what kind of housing is good.
Well, Alexis, thank you for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Alexis Sobel-Fitz, co-anchor of the Cross Sections blog and contributing editor at Columbia Journalism Review. You can find a link to read her article, The Psychology of Living in Small Spaces. The link is at our website, wordofmouthradio.org.
Word of mouth.
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 Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Before the break, we looked into some realities of micro-living. Now a story about people clinging to tiny slivers of property in the face of powerful market forces. It comes to us from Roman Mars and 99% Invisible.
There's a neighborhood in Seattle called Ballard. It used to be its own city until it was annexed into Seattle in 1907, so it's always had the feel of a small town. A lot of single-family homes and small businesses. That started to change around 2005 when Ballard started to see unprecedented growth. Tons of new condos and apartment buildings were springing up.
And around this time, a developer decided to build a shopping mall on a more or less vacant block in Ballard.
That's our producer, Katie Mingle.
Vacant except for one steadfast tenant who had been there for the last 50 years. Her name, Edith Macefield.
The developers offered Mrs. Macefield $1 million for her tiny house,
which was appraised at about $120,000. She said no.
The Ballard woman who refused to sell her little house to developers.
The little old lady being bullied by developers.
The story was classic David and Goliath. Edith Macefield versus the big bad developers.
Hi, I'm Barry Martin. I work in construction as a project superintendent.
Barry Martin was hired to oversee the shopping center project, and when he heard about Edith Macefield, he wasn't super excited.
All she has to do is complain, tell somebody at the TV station or on the newspaper, or, you know, it'll be a really big deal.
But even though the press was clamoring to talk to Mrs. Macefield, she wanted nothing to do with talking to them. Here's Mrs. Macefield turning down help from a CBS reporter as she took out some trash in her front yard.
Do you want some help, Edith?
No.
Later in the segment, he knocks on her door, and you can hear a muffled, "Go away."
Is there any...
Go away.
Okay.
Unfortunately, that muffled recording of a cranky Mrs. Macefield is the only one we could find of her.
The construction project got underway.
And all the while, Mrs. Macefield went about her business day after day, just like she'd always done.
She'd get up in the morning and feed the birds and throw bird seed out on the sidewalk. Most of the time, the bird seed would be there when we got to work.
If they didn't see the bird seed, Barry would knock on her door to see if she was okay.
And she would usually yell at me to get the hell out of there and go away and leave her alone.
A year passed, and the building around Edith Macefield's house got bigger and bigger.
And Barry kept dropping off business cards, telling her to call if she needed anything. And then one day, she finally did.
Could I give her a ride to go get her hair done? You know, we got her in the car and started driving over there, and we were kind of talking about how, you know, Ballard was changing.
And sort of surprisingly, Edith Macefield wasn't angry about the way Ballard was changing. She wasn't even angry about the mall they were building more or less on top of her house.
She said, because it always changes. That's just the way it goes. She had no reason to move. She didn't have any family. So getting the money so that she could leave it for her family didn't exist.
Mrs. Macefield didn't have any living family to leave any money to. And by the same token, she didn't have any family to help take care of her in her old age.
Pretty soon, Barry started taking her to all of her appointments. Then he got concerned that Mrs. Macefield, who was getting more frail by the day, was going to burn herself on her stove, so...
I just started swinging by there after work and making her dinner.
Pretty soon, Barry was making her lunch and breakfast as well.
One day I woke up and I'm making her three meals a day.
Barry took care of Mrs. Masefield for nearly a year and a half, visiting with her on weekends and after work. Sometimes she'd call in the middle of the night and tell him she'd had an accident and she needed him.
You know, she had very few wishes. One, she wanted to die in her house, you know, live out her last days in her house. And I was able to help fulfill those wishes.
Edith Masefield died in her house on June 15th, 2008. She was 86 years old. She left her house to Barry Martin, the construction superintendent who became her friend while simultaneously sandwiching her house between a Trader Joe's and an LA Fitness.
And our thanks to Roman Mars and 99% Invisible for that story. Millions of people with life-threatening allergies carry EpiPens. That's the registered trademark for auto-injectors of epinephrine, which can reverse anaphylaxis and other severe allergic reactions. But as Ike Swetlitz reports for Stat, the price of EpiPens has more than quintupled since 2004, leaving many desperate families and emergency medical responders to use possibly less safe and less precise manual syringes. Ike Swetlitz, thank you for joining us and welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you for having me.
How much does an EpiPen prescription generally cost?
So the list price right now is somewhere around $600 for a pack of two, and they only sell them in packs of two, so you have to pay that much. Many people are covered by some sort of insurance, so they might not be seeing that full price, but that's what they're listing for.
So if, like most people, you want a set at home and a set at school, that could cost you $1,200.
Right.
Is this covered by most insurance plans?
So it depends what sort of insurance you have. So if you have a plan with a high deductible, meaning you have to spend a lot of money before the insurance kicks in, this might be under that deductible and you'll end up having to pay the full cost. If you have a different type of insurance plan, it might be covered. I've spoken with patients who are seeing this big cost and also patients who are getting most of it covered by insurance.
Well, obviously, these are for use in emergencies, but you don't necessarily want to use them. How long are they considered effective before expiring?
So I've spoken with people who say they've seen expiration dates anywhere from about 6 months to a year and a half. It seems like a year is about the average from when they would expire. Now, patients also tell me that it's better to use an expired EpiPen than to do nothing. So the expired ones can still be good for something, but most people seem to want to replace them when they expire. Schools may also require students to have EpiPens that have not officially expired on file. So even if it might be good for a little bit of time after it expires, families will run into regulatory issues with the school.
That's very expensive. And of course, epinephrine is the drug, but the EpiPen is an auto-injector. It's a brand of a pharmaceutical company called Mylan. Are they the only players in this game?
So there are some other companies. There is an alternative auto-injector. It works a little bit differently. Many fewer prescriptions were written for that over the past few years, and then there's a generic version of that alternative. But by and large, the EpiPen is most brand recognition. Mylan is sort of the biggest player in this game.
Ike, you report in your article that over 3.6 million prescriptions of EpiPen kits written last year. Why the sharp rise in prices, and what is that rise exactly?
So looking at the data, I saw a rise, I think, just over 450% since around 2004, and that's in the price that the manufacturer is selling it for. Again, not necessarily the price that an individual is purchasing it for. There are different theories that people have about why the price has gone up so much. As we've looked at the prescription data, most of the auto-injectors that are prescribed are EpiPens, so they have a very large market share and have more control over the price. There's also been changes in the types of insurance plans that people have, so people are seeing a higher price. And there was an application for a generic version of the EpiPen, which was just sort of put on hold earlier this year, that some people have also said may be a reason why the price has continued to go up this year, but it's something that's been going on since the mid-2000s. I even heard from one person who was giving me data about how much, you know, they were paying for EpiPens back in the 80s, and the price has really only gone up since then.
That's a big hit for schools who are required to stock them, EMTs, of course, and other first responders. Now, you found that there are several states that are using an alternative, syringes used to deliver epinephrine from a vial. How much is being saved, and where are they doing that?
So it's being done in a lot of different states, about 10 states or so at the various stages of this program. Either local emergency service administrators want to start implementing it, all the way up to programs across the state to train emergency responders to be able to do this. Cost savings are still being quantified exactly. You know, some advocates of this say it can save millions of dollars for a given state. But I do want to point out with this also that this is injecting from a regular syringe. You know, this is something that paramedics, the highest trained level of emergency responders and some other emergency responders already do with many drugs. What's sort of different about what's going on is training the regular EMTs, sort of the lowest level responders, to be able to do this.
And this is being done especially in rural districts where they have volunteer fire departments, that kind of thing.
Right. And that's part of where they're seeing this cost increase the most, because it makes up such a large percentage of their budget.
Okay, so obviously it takes some training for EMTs and other first responders perhaps to learn how to use the EpiPens. Any other drawbacks, though, on either dosage or efficacy using the syringe and vial method instead of the auto-injector?
It does take longer to pull a liquid from a vial into a syringe and then inject it in someone else than it does to jab them with an auto-injector. How much longer depends on how much training you have. And, you know, people might disagree about whether the extra 30 seconds or minute or so that it takes to prepare that is worth it. It's also, when you draw a drug into a syringe, you have to draw a certain dose, right? Whereas the auto-injectors are pre-dosed.
Mm-hmm.
So you don't have to worry about how much of the drug you're putting into the syringe and how much of it is getting out of the syringe into the person. Most of these auto-injectors have two different versions, one for the children's dose and one for the adult's dose. Emergency responders carry around two of them, right? But if they were able to draw it from the vial into the syringe, they would only need, you know, one vial, and they would just either draw the children's dose or the adult's dose. Now, critics would say that might make them more susceptible to error because they might accidentally draw more than they're supposed to for the person that they're treating.
Well, in addition to training first responders and emergency professionals, how about people at home giving this to their kids or themselves? That's a pretty high bar to cross, learning how to use a syringe and distribute a drug correctly.
Yeah, so the people who I spoke with who were considering doing this, you know, they might have needed to learn how to administer the syringe. But for those individuals, those syringes would have been pre-filled at a doctor's office, or at least that's with the woman who I spoke with for my story. So they wouldn't need to learn how to draw up the medication and make sure they have the dosing right and all of that. They would take the vials and the syringes into the doctor's office and have them do it, and really just need to learn how to give the shot.
What's the difference in cost in a dose of epinephrine via syringe and via auto-injector? Do you know?
Each of the vials would have a few doses in it. Cost a few dollars, depending on the provider. Syringes are a negligible cost, including the cost that it would that someone would incur taking it to the doctor's and office and having them fill it for them. I think this one told me it was something like, you know, $20 to fill a few syringes, which last approximately 3 months.
The cost has driven officials in 10 states, as you mentioned, to push for more training for EMTs. I mean, we do have precedent for policymakers pressing for lower costs of prescription drugs or supporting alternatives. How about on this front, any movement legislatively to lower the cost of EpiPens or some alternative?
I'm not aware of any policy programs. There are programs that the manufacturer Mylan has to distribute EpiPens, in some cases free to schools, or to offer discounts for people who have certain types of insurance plans. Most of the policy initiatives that I've seen around EpiPens or around epinephrine auto-injectors have either been about increasing the availability of them in different places or about allowing EMTs or other people to be trained to use syringes.
Ike Sweatless, he reports for the health and medicine website STAT. Thank you for speaking with us.
Thank you.
You can read Ike's article, "The High Price of EpiPens Spurs Consumers, EMTs, to Resort to Syringes for Allergic Reactions." The link is at our website, wordofmouthradio.org. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. The Bookshelf is a chance to hear NHPR's All Things Considered host, Peter Biello, with regional authors. Today, writer Paul Hertnecki.
Paul Hertnecki grew up near Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, at a time when the steel industry kept many families afloat. His town, Ambridge, was a place full of working-class people, including immigrant families from all over Europe, that found themselves down on their luck when the steel industry fell apart. In his new memoir, Rust Belt Boy, Hertnecki writes about how this town left an indelible mark and still has a pull on him, even now as he lives hundreds of miles away in Hancock, New Hampshire. He joins me now to talk about his book. Welcome, Paul.
Thank you.
I wanted to ask you to start us off by reading a brief portion of your book, a paragraph from the chapter called Where Stories Went to Die.
Okay. From the time I was a toddler, my father slowed the car as we passed Byers' twin Bessemer converters that were open to Duss Avenue. I would stand on the back seat and watch the giant thermos-shaped smelters tip skyward and shoot flames, sparks, and gobs of molten iron into the night air. 30 feet tall and girded with heavy iron, these twin behemoths exhaled a sulfurous cloud that bathed the Ford in a warm wave, like standing in front of Godzilla when he's really pissed off. And I saw that show and felt that breath every week. Awesome. It ignited something in me that still burns.
What is that something?
I think it's the heat of industry. You know, I'm a fan of factory tours. I like seeing things be made. It's the cooperation of people to make something that's far beyond themselves. And I think that once you see the spectacle of heavy industry, whether it's the giant rooms of clattering textile looms, or it's this kind of scene, there's something about the noise, the awe of it, that takes you beyond yourself.
You've seen more than just a tour of these places. You took some time away from college to actually work in one of these. Tell us about your experience working in an industry like this.
It's really hard to describe because it's been described in cliche ways so many times. Steel workers being roughnecks and kind of brutal men. But there were women in the mill as well. And it was a very well-organized system of hard work and productivity. My part of it was frightening a little bit because I was in a mechanical labor gang, which meant that we were responsible for maintaining the mill. And we had to go into difficult, dangerous places all the time. You really see a need for a labor union when you're in that situation because I was repeatedly asked to put myself into really, you know, death-defying situations, and a few times had to ask for the union to step in and make a ruling.
And that's the kind of work that, when you were a kid, I mean, parents were doing, uncles, fathers. When you were a kid, how aware of the dangers that your family members were in when they went to work were you?
Pretty aware, since occasionally news of a critical injury would come down, or even a death. I remember when our next-door neighbor, Rudy Henger, who was a production guy at the Armco steel mill, where we made pipes, slipped and fell down a mountain of pipe and was crushed. He lived, but he was never the same.
There was a period of prosperity when people had jobs, the Vietnam War especially. There was a need for that kind of thing, materials that would support the war effort. But you write in the book that the one word that people tended to not use was unsustainable. What was it like living in that time where there was this prosperity, but there was also this feeling that this can't last?
It fed a kind of futility that we often felt, in that forces bigger than us were in control of our lives. we could see that things were not going to be sustainable, that that the face of the world was changing. But I guess there was a feeling that we would just chase one opportunity into the next, and it would keep coming. My father knew better, and he thought that plans should be made for the industry modernizing. But as it turns out, globalism really had its way, and we saw the handwriting on the wall. We saw the, you know, the Asian characters written on steel blooms. So we knew that things were being done differently, and I don't think there was a whole lot of innovation happening. And they weren't really thinking about sustainability. I think they were, most of the corporate entities, like U.S. Steel and Armco Steel, were thinking about expansion of their businesses through different products and different endeavors.
So how often do you go back?
I tend to go back twice, maybe three times a year.
Yeah.
I still have family there.
Do you go back just for family?
I did for many, many years, and friends, because some friends there are still my best friends. But also, I'm a student of the place now.
To be a student and to study this place, do you need distance?
Yeah, I think it helps. I write very little about New England, for instance, because I live here. I also found I used to do a lot of photography when I was doing magazine journalism in places where I'd otherwise have to hire a photographer to go. I would shoot for my own stories. And I found that I would very seldom do stories about New England or about places close to me, so or near to me. So Ambridge was a place I felt like I had to get away from for quite a while in order to see it not only objectively, but also to see it in a way that people outside that place would understand. What's important to a New Yorker about a place like Ambridge? What's important to a Vermonter about that, or a Californian, even if they've had no brush with it? And I think I did need that distance.
Well, Paul, thank you very much for speaking with me about your book.
Thank you, Peter. Thanks for your interest.
Peter Biello there, speaking with Paul Hertnecki about his new memoir, Rust Belt Boy. You can listen to other episodes of The Bookshelf on your own schedule by subscribing to the podcast on iTunes or Google Play. Paul Hertnecki will be reading from his work at Gibson's Bookstore in Concord tonight at 5:30. And we have a postscript today from Anna Holmes, writing in The New Yorker. Many women can tell you when and where they first read a Judy Blume book, but I'm pretty sure that a lot of them can't remember exactly how they got their hands on it. That's because, like a beloved pet or well-worn pair of sneakers, her books were always just sort of there, part of the architecture and set dressing of many a young girl's life. Blume's books were dog-eared talismans that, for a significant segment of the American female population, marked the passage from childhood to adolescence. And it wasn't just girls who turned to Judy Blume to better understand their inner lives and desires. Here's author Juno Diaz talking with Studio 360's Kurt Anderson.
Well, yeah, I have two sisters, man, and we're like almost the same age. So, of course, because you're a teenage boy, you're thinking, oh, my sister's reading this. This is going to be a map for
I can learn
future
something.
Conquest, you know?
There is still plenty to learn from Judy Blume, and you can hear her for yourself at Writers on a New England Stage at the Music Hall in Portsmouth this Thursday. Tickets and information at wordofmouthradio.org. I'm Virginia Prescott, back with more Word of Mouth tomorrow at 2 here on NHPR.
Word of Mouth is produced by Molly Donahue,
Logan Shannon,
and Jimmy Gutierrez.
Our senior producer is
Taylor Quimby,
and our executive producer is Maureen McMurray.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals
and not those of NHPR,
its Board of Trustees,
or its underwriters. Word of Mouth is a production
of New Hampshire
Public Radio.